Back in the early 20th century, when lynchings were not uncommon in the American South, a brave, light-skinned black man from the North posed as a white man in order to report the atrocities. This story provides the basis for our next guest's latest book. Matt Johnson is an award-winning writer, and he's here with us now to discuss his new graphic novel, Incognegro. Matt Johnson, welcome to Fair Game.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
I'm excited, too. You preface your book by saying your own experience has a lot to do with why you chose to write about passing. Your story is so interesting. Tell us about your childhood and growing up in Philadelphia.
I grew up in the Germantown section of Philadelphia. It's a predominantly black neighborhood. And I was an African-American child who looked white to most appearances. I had light brown hair, pink skin, and most of the things that little white kids have. But I also had an ancestry that connected me back to Africa and a slave past and ethnic history. So my childhood, and also my early adulthood and even today was partly negotiating that fact of what it is to be African-American when, the rest of society or the majority of society sees you as white.
Was it difficult to have that appearance as a child where you lived?
Well, it wasn't easy. I mean, I grew up in like the height of the Black Power movement, the mid-70s, and, was walking around Germantown with the, a dashiki on and a straight-haired afro. So it led to...
What does that even look like? I think I had that in high school.
Yeah, I think Will Ferrell was sporting one in his latest movie. So, I still get it today if it gets too humid. But, yeah, it was difficult. I mean, everybody has their difficulties and kind of fitting in. But, and the African-American community is really a Creole community. It's not just, people from Africa, but, ancestry from Native American. And a huge part of the ancestry is from Europe. But with me, it was a more extreme case. I just happened to look more European. So it kind of set me outside of the rest of the culture. It also made me a writer. So, I appreciate the experience.
And the hero in your book, Zane Pinchback, is an African-American man who looks white. And he kind of, he becomes this race spy. Is that a fantasy you had as a child growing up in Germantown?
Yeah, that was like if I was six and you took me to Fantasy Island, that's the adventure I would have lived out. And I used to play my cousin Ben and I, who was also mixed. I was black and Irish. He was black and Jewish. And we used to play in his backyard and had this fantasy about like going back to the slavery era and, being able to help people escape in the Underground Railroad by, pretending to be white and, really kind of taking something that was sort of difficult in my life and was a sort of conundrum that had to be resolved in my identity and turning it into something that was adventurous and something that was actually a positive attribute that could help people. That's where the fantasy came from.
Matt, how did the birth of your decidedly not identical twins in 2005 shape your thinking?
It shaped my thinking in a lot of ways, mostly about what it means to sleep 8 hours a night, but the other parts of it.
Will you describe what they look like?
Right. One of my son has more European pink type skin, and he has reddish hair, very red hair. And my daughter has brown skin and more African tight curled hair. And they look like they're two different from two different ethnic groups. And of course, they're ethnically identical. And, just the kind of fluke of genetics. My son, I originally was planning on naming him Kojo. And then when he came out looking like he, was at the University Hospital in Cork, I decided, Liam might be a better name for him.
I was going to say Fergus, but Liam's good. Okay.
Yeah, Fergus. Yeah, maybe Fergus the middle name. But so I just kind of brought home, now we're in a very different society. Obviously, racism is not gone, white supremacy is not gone, but the civil rights movement has been largely won. So it's a very different situation. But I was thinking, if this was in the early 20th century, my children, who are twins, would have had dramatically different opportunities available to them, in part because of gender, but also largely because of race. And so that kind of gave me the final piece of the puzzle in my head of what it would have been like for my son Liam or for mm-hmm. myself to be in the early 20th century and how we would have negotiated that. And that's where the seeds for Incognegro were born. I ended up writing the entire manuscript the summer after they were born, and I had all those pieces there.
Well, the primary inspiration for the hero of your book was someone who lived in the early 20th century, Walter Francis White, the former head of the NAACP. Tell me what you learned about him that captured your imagination.
Well, I think if you can just Google Walter White and you look at this former head of the NAACP who's African American and see his picture, that's enough to capture your imagination right there. I mean, he looks, you know, Dick Cheney looks blacker than him. I mean, he really has, you know, sort of no real African appearance. And when I first started doing research and as an undergrad into the Harlem Renaissance, which I have a huge affection for, Walter White kind of stood out to me as somebody who, you know, I understood the situation he was in. He was not a perfect person. And he investigated lynchings and did a lot of other brave things. But he also, you know, was also in some ways limited by his time. But I like that idea. There's a famous story of him getting on a train, leaving a lynching that he was investigating, and someone coming up to him and saying, hey, don't you know there's this black, well, they didn't use the word black, but a black investigator in the town who looks like a white man. They're going to lynch him. Hmm. And this he finds out as he's leaving. And I think that always kind of stuck in my mind. And you know, for the entertainment's sake, it interests me, but also it interests me this kind of this duality and, you know, this interesting kind of position that you can be in when people don't recognize you for who you are in a society where there's tension between those identities.
Does this all lead you to conclude that race isn't a real thing, that it is only a social construction?
Yeah, I'd love to say that. I mean, I know I don't believe in race. Like, in the idea of like what Kant first described as race, and you know, the Enlightenment ideal of race that we kind of cling to today, that just seems kind of ridiculous. But I do believe in ethnicity, and I do believe there's the ethnicity influences the way we see the world, and I also believe that people within this world are affected by their history, the history of their ethnic groups, and you know, the history not just of black people, the history of white people in this country, the history of Latinos. We all are kind of walking with our baggage, and so I believe we're affected by it. But the idea of race, of being a black person or being a white person, no, it doesn't really hold up. And I think one of the exciting things about this new century is I think by the time we get to the end of the 21st century, I think we're going to have a dramatically different idea about how ethnicity informs a personal identity in this country.
Matt, please hang on a minute. We'll talk a little more after the break. Also coming up, we'll talk to a scientist who says obesity is socially contagious. I'm Faith Saley, and this is Fair Game from PRI. I'm Faith Saley, and this is Fair Game from PRI. We're talking with Matt Johnson, whose new graphic novel Incognito follows a black journalist who's trying to pass for white. Matt, before the break, we were talking about American race, identity, and appearance. You may know this because you have a red-haired son, Liam, but they say in 100 years there won't be any redheads. Have you heard that?
Sure, but you know what? They don't take into account that redheads breed like rabbits. I mean, there's no way they're going to get rid of them. I say this as an Irishman as well. I mean, I think redheads are going to be just fine. But yeah, I think, you know, the idea of what an American is going to be so different as we move forward now, because we, you know, as black people and Latinos and other and Asians move into the middle class, intermarriage is very common. We're probably in 1,000 years, if America still stands, there's going to be an idea of an ethnic America, which we can't even imagine at this point.
Early on in your book, your hero, Zane Pinchback, gets into character as a white man in order to investigate a lynching. And I want to read what his thoughts are. Race is just a bunch of rules meant to keep us on the bottom. Race is a strategy. The rest is just people acting, playing roles. That's what white folks never get. They don't think they have accents. They don't think they eat ethnic foods. Their music is classical. They think they're just normal. That's what makes them so easy to infiltrate. So Zane is living in the 1930s. Matt, do you think that America has changed since then? Do you think his thoughts there still hold true?
Well, I think America has changed dramatically since the 1930s. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be in this country. But yeah, the elements of it, I think, are still true. It's fascinating watching a lot of the political discourse in the Democratic Party over, you know, as Obama being supported by poor voters. And of course he was being supported by poor voters. He was being supported by poor black voters. But and sometimes in this culture, what is white, what is ethnically European in this culture, just gets seen as the norm, and everything else is ends up being kind of ethnic. When you say eating ethnic foods, you're usually not talking about, you know, Franks and beans. It's so the fact that we kind of see a normal culture, seeing European as being normal, and everything else as being kind of a deviation from the norm, I think, you know, still exists to a degree.
What do you think about the conversation about race that's surrounding Obama and the one that he started with his speech a couple of weeks ago?
It's blowing my mind. I think, like, I did not see this coming. The majority of people I grew up with and went to college with and of my own kind of cast did not see this coming. And I was just...
When you say that, what do you mean? Did you not think that this soon there would be a black man running for president, or no one would be talking about it so explicitly, or what?
Oh, a black man runs for president all the time. They just never win. So to see him win wasn't really... I mean, Iowa, I think I had a migraine for 3 days after Iowa because my perception of the world physically changed. So there's that part of it. The other part of it is it was fascinating for me watching the speech, and I've talked about that. I just had a whole conversation with another writer of Mixed Race about this. Watching Obama do the speech that he gave on race, it was interesting because he pivoted to not having the speech as a black man, but pivoted it to have a speech as a biracial man and as a mulatto. And that I did not expect. I mean, the conversation he was having about race was one that mixed people have had in this country for the last century. But it's usually not a private, it's not a public conversation. It's usually a private conversation. To hear him talk about himself, start off with the position, my father was a black man, my mother was a white man, I have ancestors over here, I have ancestors over there, was him positioning himself away from the idea with the right comments of, you know, all of a sudden, the big change was that all of a sudden Obama became a black man. And so part of his addressing that was saying, you know, and I don't think people really dealt with that, but him saying, no, I'm not just black, I'm also I also have a white ancestry. And so it's been interesting seeing how people relate to it. It's kind of a litmus test at this point, how you see Obama as a character. So, yeah, I'm really beyond my own limited understanding. I'm just like sitting at home with popcorn and watching everything that's happening.
Now, you mentioned that you have an affection for the Harlem Renaissance, and your story has a great deal of period detail, particularly in how you depict Harlem and the lynchings in the Deep South. And so, you know, it's very apparent you did a lot of research. What were some things you learned that surprised you about that time period and that place?
I think one of the things that surprised me is the idea, a lot of the ideas that we have about race, about gender, and about sexuality that seem so modern were almost commonplace in some of the literary salons of Harlem. The presence of a gay identity or a transgender identity was fairly common among the artists and intellectuals in the Harlem Renaissance.
Wow.
In a way that won't become common in the rest of America until much later, because they get it. They get the idea of the mask of identity. And which is so easily applied to sexuality. It's fascinating. One of the things I see when I look at their work, I look at people like Wallace Thurman, who wrote a fantastic book called Infants of the Spring. And he, in that book, he kind of talks about this artistic community, this kind of sexually mischievous, intellectually mischievous artistic community. And you really see the seeds of understanding about racial identity that probably won't move into the mainstream until today. Most of the people who read that book at the time probably had no idea what he was talking about it. But a lot of times when you look to the past, and particularly when you look to the Harlem Renaissance, you find these time capsules that were sealed away, hoping that someday there would be a community or a readership out there that could open them and understand what these people were getting at. And that's, you know, it's these hunt for Easter eggs that I really enjoy about it.
Matt, we have about a minute left, and I want to know, in your own life, because to many people you appeared white, have people said things to you that you know they wouldn't have said if they knew you were black?
Oh, sure.
Can you give an example?
This week?
Really?
You hear comments. I mean, you get in a cab and you hear, racial slurs. I think one of the things I really find is people who do know who I am and do know my ethnic identity. I teach at the University of Houston's Creative Writing Program. I've taught at a lot of other colleges. So people know who I am. But a lot of times people feel uncomfortable because they don't know if maybe they'll put their guard down and forget that I'm a Negro and then say something and then be branded forever a racist. So, you know, I get this kind of this discomfort that goes around it. And I'm out thinking there's also African Americans who've said things in front of me, kind of forgetting that I have another, you know, that my father is white and that I have a connection to the other community. So, you know, I'm very forgiving because I hear kind of sort of intolerance and kind of quick racism, easy racism said by everybody.
Finally, Matt, for Halloween, do you like dressing your son Liam, the red-haired child, up as Incognito? Is that his favorite superhero?
I think I'm going to dress him in a kufi and a lot of African garb to remind him who he is.
Blow everybody's mind.
Yeah, and Chloe's going to be wearing a Celtic garb, and she's definitely doing Irish dance. But for me, I'm actually on the cover of Incognito. That's my picture there. And the guy who took the picture gave me the hat. So next year, I am going as Incognito.
Matt Johnson, I love talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Johnson's new graphic novel is Incognito, and it's in stores now. You can learn more about him and the book on our website, morefairgame.org.